At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
We're talking about the Delphi case. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, with us. Robin, when we talk about major investigative failures, they focus on evidence. What was tested? What wasn't? Who said what? Who did what? But beneath every failure is something far more than human. It's a psychology of the people involved. And when you read the Delphi depositions, the story that jumps off the page isn't just about evidence mishandling. It's about human beings under pressure, human beings making emotional decisions instead of analytical ones, human beings reshaping their own memories. Human beings locked inside a dysfunctional leadership structure. Human beings whose internal belief systems might have influenced the case more than the actual evidence did. So today, I want to strip away the paperwork and look at the investigators themselves. How they thought, how they reacted, how they communicated, and how this case spiraled into something that looks less like an investigation and more like a psychological implosion. So let's dive into this to begin with. From a formal, from the behavioral science standpoint, what are the easiest and the earliest warning signs that an investigative team is beginning to fracture internally? And how do you see those signs in the Delphi depositions that have now all been released?
You know, and these can be really tough questions. And that's why I love your quote here, dysfunctional leadership structures. Yes, because basically what we're always looking for in any situation is we're looking for congruence of information, body language, behaviors, everything. We're looking for calm, basically, because anytime you're going to investigate something that creates a storm, you need a calm center so you can logically, methodically, you know, go down the path of discovering the truth. And typically, there you have a leadership structure at the top that is then dictating from their experience, from their reps, logical ways to proceed. And there are logical ways to proceed. You know, and when we do our show here, as soon as we have a case pop up, I have a procedure and a process in my brain I automatically go to for thinking about and regarding what truth is and how to discover that truth. And so what we see in this case from the very get-go was chaos. Mm-hmm. And so anytime you have chaos, the first thing I think of is we don't have leadership. And when chaos ensues, frustration ensues, not just frustration with the investigators, the prosecutors, the defense, and most importantly, the families and the victims of the crime or horrendous action that happened. And then you look at where you do have congruence of behavior or incongruence. And in this case, I have been from the very get-go and still hold firm to Richard Allen was nothing but congruence of behavior. He was very congruent all throughout this, even with, and we'll get to it if you want to, the supposed confession that he did to protect his wife and family, which, by the way, I did the research again on this. In the entire time that in recorded history of any cases I could look up and draw up in deep research with AI and everything else, there has never, ever been a confession that was given where his entire reason he gave it was to protect his wife.
At least not that there's been the record of that on.
And I said record, right.
Yeah, where that was the reasoning on, yeah.
Right. I mean, he was very clear in his courtroom call, I mean, his jail room calls and everything about his focus entirely all the time was his wife and family. Every single other confession, and there's only one other one, I don't remember the case right now, that came kind of close, but it was actually because of trying to self-protection. Because most of the time, people confess to protect themselves. They protect themselves to get a better deal, to lobby for something, for guilt, remorse, And what we saw here was not that. And that's why we have an incongruence of that behavior.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big thing when you look at Richard Allen and you look at, if we go to that angle of looking at those interrogations of him, the way that he handled it, the way that he acted. And if you were to compare that to other cases where you have, and in most cases, you have an extremely narcissistic human being who is trying to justify whatever bullshit they did, whatever lies they're going to spew and whatever they're going to do. That was not Richard Allen. That was not that interview. That was not that same sort of guy. This was literally a guy who's like, I'm going to throw myself in front of a train for my family if I think you're the train that's coming at me. And he literally did. If we're talking about how this all played out, it is so diametrically different than other cases when you look at the character of the man who he is and the history of the man who he is. It's shocking how different it is. I don't really understand how some people can see it any other way.
Well, here's how. And this goes to the point of what you know, the opening question is, and this is the investigative team. And so he is now, granted, all things I always try to do is maintain objectivity at all times. I'm just saying, from a behavior standpoint, him being guilty is a complete outlier from everything we're seeing behaviorally from him. Now, he could be an outlier. Outliers happen in society. They happen in nature. But in order to be convinced that he is an actual outlier, we need prosecution to allow everyone to see all the evidence that they have and allow defense to present everything that might be a mitigator of these things, to be able to talk about actual evidence that wasn't lost, interviews that weren't lost, confessions from other people that weren't able to be admitted. I mean, there's so much.
And let's talk about that, because there is so much chaos in this case. Two of the lead investigators can't even agree on a deposition in terms of, was the FBI fired from the case? Did they kick them out? Did anybody kick them out, or are they still there? If you can't even get the basics down of who's involved, who's sticking their hand into this cookie jar that you supposedly have all this control over, and you just want to make so local, and your two lead investigators have no clue who's actually coming and going, I mean, what the hell is that? I mean, either that's a cover-up of some sort and nobody knows what the official story is, or just extreme dysfunction.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to have conjecture about what they actually do. And I hate throwing law enforcement because they have a tough job under the bus. But at the same time, though, what we're seeing is what the appearance is of massive confirmation bias after pressure was put on after a number of years of not having any movement. For whatever reason, they put it on the back burner. Or I think it's just, I really think it's lazy incompetence. And why do I say that? I don't have a lot of data points, but when you look at the data points of how they conducted the interview/interrogation of Richard Allen, I'm like, these senior looking guys were horrible at the interview. And so that's a data point you're seeing with all these other data points of incompetence. Do I think it's intentional incompetence? Not necessarily. I just think they, you know, my technical term, they're being stupid. And I think they're going for a conclusion that they already had predetermined. And so when you have your own confirmation bias of what you're trying to see and what you're trying to find, you exclude everything else, or you make it easy to not find it. You make it easy to get rid of it. You make it easy for it to disappear, you know, and when you kick out objectivity, and this is what's really key in investigations. And we've seen this with other cases we cover all the time, including like the Epstein case. When you are so close because it's a small town, and this is the case of the kid that was just all but acquitted of raping those two girls, you know, because the lawyer, I mean, because the judge lived there for 50 years.
In Stillwater,
In Stillwater, you wind up so close to the case that's why you call in someone objective. That's why you call in the FBI. That's why you call in people that don't have a vested interest in the outcome. They're there objectively to be your loving critic. They kicked it out. When you kick out objectivity and you have that kind of confirmation bias in a small town and you're trying to serve, I'll give them benefit of the doubt. They're trying to serve the victim's families. Okay. But now you're victimizing someone else.
Yeah. The Delphi investigators, we're staring down a furious public, literally years of no answers, national attention, years of dead ends, overwhelming emotional pressure. There's a lot that certainly was on them to try and get to some sort of an answer. And when we watch those interviews, and we're talking about what went on in the interrogation room with Rick Allen, they seem very confident in their ways. Now, it's easy for us to Monday morning quarterback it, or just, you know, look at it from, hey, here's what's effective, here's what's not. Maybe we should learn a little better ways of interviewing people today in 20 or whatever year this was when this took place. But they seem to be kind of stuck in a certain way of doing things. When we look at that, when we look at just how they handled it, these are folks that I don't think look back on their performance, and I'm going to call it a performance, and it's their interrogation. And I think I don't think they look at it from the angle you're looking at it from. I don't think they're looking back on that going, we could have done better. I'm going to guess they're still looking at it going, we knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, maybe, most likely, who knows. Unfortunately, what you tend to do is you tend to be your own worst critic, or not. But sure. Like in that interview, the likelihood of them looking at themselves too much is the problem, because what they weren't looking at was Richard Allen. And it's easy for people that are in that position to be the Monday morning quarterback, and then for them to call out someone like me being critical. And what I'm not doing is I'm not being critical, because that was a tough situation if they don't have a lot of reps doing that. But what they weren't really paying attention to, Richard Allen didn't spike their curiosity, because that's what you got to be as an investigator. And even there, if they went in trying to find truth rather than trying to prove he's wrong or get him to admit he's wrong, and those are two different things. When you're doing an interview, especially at the stage of the investigation they were with him, is when he says something or comes back with something, or more importantly, his entire demeanor is giving you pause and saying, huh, I was expecting, if he's guilty, for him to behave this way. I was expecting denials. I wasn't expecting him to be so casual, so easygoing, so here's my cell phone, because he wasn't given the behaviors of trying to hide anything, of being obscuring anything. He was being as open and transparent as humanly possible. And they did a great job establishing an initial rapport, but they already had in their mind he thought he did it. And so they went right to the accusatory, which is they lost. And again, we cover this all the time. When a human being, especially an investigator, loses their objective curiosity, you're sunk. Because then you're just trying to find the facts that support the conclusion you're going for. And I think that's what we started seeing very early on.
And they're human. I mean, it's no way to dismiss it. But I mean, how does, from an operational standpoint, how does long-term frustration warp an investigator's sense of what is true, even if unintentionally, when you're looking to fit something in this peg hole here, and it's a circle, and all you seem to have is a square?
Yeah. So what happens is the tribe mentality takes over. And what, say you're in, so we'll do a thought experiment, which I'd love to do. So here you are, you're in a smallish town. Everyone knows each other really well. And people are getting frustrated. People you know are getting frustrated. There's a lot of local chatter going around. And people start needling you, poking at you, telling you how incompetent you are. And then most likely what happens is that someone comes up with a narrative. So Richard Allen, it wasn't originally even named, but Richard Allen lived kind of close. The possibility of someone locally, maybe someone who wanted to defend the fact that the next door neighbor was a convicted pedophile or accused of it or something like that, want to protect them. So someone puts in someone's mind, it's probably Richard Allen. And then that narrative in a small cloistered area takes a hold, takes effect. And they keep poking, they keep poking, they keep poking, till finally, that's all that investigation team starts hearing. So they lose the objectivity of truth and trying to find the data to support that or maintain it open. And now they're trying to please a public that is calling for this specific thing. I mean, we see this on social media all the time. I mean, we consume information to validate our own self-opinion. And if their self-opinion became survival because they wanted to be liked, they feared being ostracized by the community because it's a small community, who knows all these reasons, but when you are in a small community where a community loses its objectivity because they're seeking an outcome, which is just justice for the girls, and there's zero investigative progress because they were incompetent, then this is what happens. They locked onto someone, or someone in that community locked onto something, and the entire community got confirmation bias. And why do I think that? Because the jury found him guilty. That's why I think that.
I think one of the biggest questions in this case, especially today, now that we're looking back and we have all of the depositions, we have all of the evidence, including, and we can see all the things that were not admitted into trial, especially all of the Odinism work. We're learning the FBI came up with the Odinism theory. The Behavioral Analysis Unit came up with the Odinism theory, which is quite powerful. And then we also have two suspects early on. I believe they were suspects, and if they weren't, I apologize. But you have two individuals. You have one who had literal Facebook posts of girls, and if there were his daughter's friend, somebody, that were laying in on the ground in the wilderness with sticks. It almost looked like they were reconstructing the crime scene with Odinistic ruins on them. There was talk about this person being an Odinist. There was evidence showing that this was part of their belief system. It's up there. It's online. This is not made up stuff. This is a very peculiar, if you just had a murder and then somebody's posting on Facebook, almost like weird tributes to this. You also have another person who asked one of the investigators here, I believe it was Holder. I could be incorrect. But the question was, if I spit on one of the girls, on one of the bodies, could that come back to me? Essentially, could that get me in trouble? All of these things. The investigators that we're learning about from their depositions, they all said, stuff is inconclusive. There's nothing here. I don't know, like, how what you need. I mean, other than fireworks being shot at your head saying, hey, this is something right here that you should be looking at.
Yeah, any one of those things should have derailed what they actually wound up doing. And so let's start off with first the BAU coming in and calling this Odinism as a theory.
Yeah.
They don't say things unless there's science and research to support it. So what the BAUs do, behavioral analysis units, and I was part of the behavioral analysis program. So I am always, as you all know on the show, I'm extremely careful because I don't call myself a profiler and behavioral expert because I ran our behavioral analysis program, which is a little bit different than the BAUs. Those BAU guys are so good because they base everything that they say and on science, research, and then they come with the conclusions. They use a very scientific method to come up with a profile of what they see given evidence and data. And as we saw in the yogurt murders years ago, the BAU came in, and because they didn't have enough data, they didn't give a profile of who they thought this was. And everyone was outraged that the profilers came in and they couldn't come up with the yogurt shop murders. They couldn't come up with a profile. Well, because they don't make wild ass guesses.
Yeah.
And that's why if they came in and said there's this Odinism thing here, you damn well better listen. Because they don't make shit up. And so they're basing on research, and that research is based on prior cases they've seen. They just don't come up with a theory. If they've seen it a lot, it becomes part of a profile, part of the research. And so if they come in and say this thing, you better look at it. Then the other thing that is glaring to me, especially after having covered the Epstein case so much now, and that is if you have any male of an older age that has any images of any girls that are teenage and they're not his, you got an issue that you should be exploring because that is not right. There's something creepy. And when you got creepy, that's smoke, and you got smoke, you got Odinism, we got something to focus on instead of, now granted, does that mean it's guilt? Does that mean anything else? No, but we got some smoke that needs a lot of looking at to see if it's a fire. And that's what they totally dismissed.
From a behavioral lens, what internal story, and this is just pure speculation on these investigators, because I'm trying to understand what the hell they were thinking. What internal story are they telling themselves to rationalize ignoring these red flag behaviors from other potential suspects that even the FBI is coming to you going, hey guys, this sounds kind of crazy, but we're the FBI. Look at this shit. And they're like, nah, we got it. We're good over here. We got tons of experience in homicide. Oh, wait, we don't. We have none. We got it. We're good. I mean, what's going on? What the hell is going on?
So let's place ourselves in those kind of situations. And that is, from my perspective and my optic, so here you are as an investigator, and these guys are trained. These guys have reps. They are objective when you start out. And then you have outside people like the FBI and others coming in and saying, hey, here's what we're seeing, this, this, and this. That is enough influence in your brain from your experience and from law enforcement that should be directing you down a path. And if all of a sudden that path stops and you redirect over here, I don't think these were internal choices. I really, really think that external pressure that was put on them by either community or superiors or both led them down a different path that they originally weren't going to go down, which we actually saw they weren't going down. They were actually exploring these things, and all of a sudden it went sideways. It's hard to imagine because I can't – now, granted, I'm doing my best to be that deep act of empathy where I'm placing myself in their shoes. If I'm in their shoes and I don't have external pressures – those are the paths I'm choosing to go down. You don't have to be a behavior expert. All you have to do is have access to the Google machine to see that Richard Allen's pattern of behavior does not fit other homicidal killers of girls. It just doesn't fit. And so when you have that non-fit, which is a very, very clear non-fit, and you have outside people telling you to look over here, a reasonable investigator is going to follow that path first to its full conclusion. Now, granted, it might come out like they might have found, like I said, Richard Allen could be that outlier. But the way to figure out if he's an actual outlier is you have to flush out the logical place to go first. Because here's where logic is when it comes to these types of murders. There's a connection to the girls, connection to the victims, basically. And you actually have patterns of behavior that might fit. You have people that have been accused in the past. You have people that have some sort of and there was a connection between one of the individuals that actually eventually, according to what we're seeing and hearing, confessed to killing the girls in jail. That's the pattern you go down. So the fact that they didn't says that I don't think it was internal to them, because any individual, just looking at as we laid it out here, just very basically, this is not complicated. You wouldn't do what they wound up doing. So the only explanation is they had outside influences that pressured them not to do that.
There's so many questions here in the Delphi case against Richard Allen, who is serving the rest of his life behind bars as of right now. Unless people wake up and go, this seems a little bit off. There seems to be a lot of problems here with this case, which if you just take the time to look at the drop of evidence and the depositions, it's just riddled with so many obvious problems. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, talking with us right now about all of this. Let's talk about those Nordic beliefs a little bit more. The Behavioral Analysis Unit came out and said that there were some initial investigators that were in on this, that were looking into it. One of them died under mysterious circumstances. The fact that this is, it's interesting because it's brought to the light of day of Odinism. This and to the general public, it's like, what? What is this? And then you start digging deeper into it. It's like, oh, well, look at all these prison guards around these Odinism tattoos. Look at all these other folks in the community who seem to have some sort of link or belief system here, or at the very least felt compelled enough to ink it up on their body. That means there's some sort of something going on here. What exactly is it? Do I think it's some sort of a child killing cult? That seems a bit out there. But at the same point, hiding it, not exploring it at all, treating it like it's completely crazy when it turns out there's a lot of evidence that points to it actually being something, it really makes you wonder what the hell the decision-making process was behind the scenes and why this idea as a whole was completely tampered down by the local investigators, telling the feds to stop investigating this, get out of our territory, we got this, and we're not going to look down this road at all. It kind of looks like you might be covering something up, or you think it's crazy. I don't know. It could be a little bit of both.
Well, I remember at the very beginning of us covering this case, my first question, one of the first questions I had when it came to this Odinism thing was, first of all, you and I even said, we're not conspiracy theory guys, but Odinism, this is weird, because let's now look at the behavior of the defense attorneys. Because that's what really struck me on this one. The entire time, you have two defense attorneys that were very staunch, hardcore, all in Richard Allen's court, and they were all in on Odinism. And I was like, what is making the, because what happened then was everyone tried portraying them as lunatics, as kooks, but it doesn't fit the narrative of these defense attorneys. They're not lunatics, they're not kooks, they're very well educated. And typically, if you have a defense attorney that then was willing to go pro bono to defend someone who they had everything stacked against, especially with Judge Gull, you know, you're like, this doesn't make sense. Why would these two defense attorneys be all in on this kooky thing that someone's, well, now we know why. Because the FBI said so. And everyone else around there, they were seeing so much that no one else was seeing. And why? Because they were tampering it down. Now here's a possibility. You know, because this became so muddled and a bit convoluted with the girls being murdered. You have the neighbor that was somewhat connected to these girls. Again, it's a little muddy to who did what, where, when, and you have another jailhouse confession to this. Now, what we don't know is, was that guy an Odinist? Wasn't he an Odinist? Did maybe an Odinist group came across these girls after they were murdered? I mean, there's so much weirdness in there that I think they just wanted to get rid of it all.
Just too dirty, just too much, just too complicated. And at the end of the day, they just needed something simple. They needed an answer for the community that had been begging them for years. And when you start to dismiss people, you start to dismiss the FBI from helping. Oh, we don't need your help anymore. And your community is still mad at you and you still don't have answers. You got to come up with something.
Yeah. So here's a great, I hate doing these conspiracy conjecture things, but now let's reverse that lens again. So here's your, let's suppose in our world of make-believe, we actually do have an Odinist group inside the Delphi area here. One of the objectives of every group and organization is what? Recruitment. Got to keep the thing alive. And if all of a sudden the community finds out, because they're trying to grow their Odinist cult, that we killed two girls, what's that resonate for recruitment?
I don't know. I don't think that would be a great sell, but no, I'm not into Odinist. I don't know if that's a big sell.
You got to push it off on the guy that's the outsider that just moved there like 10 years ago. That's not part of the Odinist cult. So
okay, it's not what they do. Okay.
Right. See? So again, pure 100% conjecture. But again, we got to explore all this is what investigators do. You got to explore all these different possibilities. So now as an investigator, I come with this theory that, all right, so let's play it out. Because this is what you do. If someone gives you an idea, one of the exhausting things that takes so much time in investigations is you follow leads or logical conclusions. So what you're trying to now do is I'm going to disprove that theory. I came up with a theory that, all right, let's suppose it's Odinist because the FBI said it's Odinist. What were some reasons why the Odinists would want this suppressed? Well, it's not a legal religion or anything like that. It seems a little kooky, a little weird, but not to them. Mm-hmm. But if it's tied to this, well, everything I just came up with. So what you now need to do is you need to flush it out so you can say, beyond a reasonable doubt, we don't have Odinists here. This isn't part of this community. And how do I prove that? Well, I interviewed this person, this person, this person, this person. And now since the FBI, now what I got to do is the FBI put in that report why they believe it's Odinism. I got to be able to flush all that out. All these things we're saying, you always have to disprove something in order to move on to something else. They didn't do it. They completely ignored it.
Was it they didn't want to have more work? they didn't want to have.
Couldn't. Or they couldn't.
Or they couldn't. Yeah.
because it actually was true. So it's either they didn't want to work or they got pressure. Remember, this thing is about pressure. Because a reasonable human being would not follow the path of Richard Allen. It just doesn't fit the pattern of his very, very easy behavior to follow. In other words, he was not a complicated person to figure out. You figured him out watching that one interview of him. I have never seen an interview of someone innocent that was different than that. He acted like someone who he wasn't hiding anything in those interviews. And that's what was really striking to me was like, wow, I was expecting X, Y, and Z because someone that even has some semblance or knowledge of these two girls or maybe some thought. I mean, here's another thing that too, he was so unaware of these two girls that he didn't even give a registration of recognition to them. And so, because even if, so again, you play this forward as an investigator, if he was even aware of these two girls' existence in life at any level where he has a connection to them, you're going to see a pause, you're going to see thoughtfulness because he might have, you know, because even if he fantasized about teenagers in any way, you're going to see that pause. You're going to see a different reaction than what you got than the completely, what? Whatever, here's my phone. I mean, his transparency in those interviews and willingness to share was good to me. And also, he doesn't live a complicated life. He doesn't have a huge social media footprint. There's nothing to be uncovered that's going to take years and years of uncovering. It's not going to be like hundreds and thousands of interviews of people you got to do in this guy. He is straightforward, pretty basic. He's a vanilla guy to look at. He's an investigator's dream because he's easy. There's nothing there. He's got a wife. He's got a kid. He's got a home. He works in a community. Boom.
Why do you think it is, Robin, that when we look at this case and we look at the treatment of Richard Allen as a pretrial suspect, where they put him away in a prison in solitary confinement, basically tortured him for more than a year. We've now seen there's been an image that has come out, basically a mugshot from within the prison system. Very grainy, it's of a man that's been tortured. Black eyes, sunken, just a shell of a human being. It looks zombie-like. Mm-hmm. And this was a man who at that point in time still had not been convicted of a single crime. Why do you think there is such a dramatic disconnect between the people who are utterly outraged by this and those that seem to think there's absolutely nothing wrong with this whatsoever in our system? I mean, again, a man who has not been convicted of a crime, basically tortured nearly to death. He could have easily died had he been in slightly worse health. He probably wanted to.
Yeah.
And this... we're just like, oh, that's cool. That's how we do it here in Indiana. Like, we're not in India. We're not in some other third world country. We're Indiana. And this is like A-okay with many people. Why? How do two different people, both seemingly normal, healthy, both maybe raising families, taking their kids to school, not abusing them, not killing them, not doing horrible things. One is just A-okay, and the other's like, what the F did I just say?
People want justice, and they're gonna jump to easy justice sometimes, and I think that's what we saw here. And you hit on the other major part of this, which I do not understand whatsoever, and that's his treatment in pretrial treatment. It was unbelievable. The torture they put him in isolation, got the confessions they wanted. I've just never seen a case like this handled this way before.
In the United States.
No, exactly. That's a good point. You know, Nelson Mandela, in his book, Long Walk to Freedom, had a great quote because he was in prison for much of his life. And it was in horrendous conditions most of the time in apartheid South Africa. And he said, you can judge the character of a nation by how it treats people like me, by its convicts, by its prison system. And now, granted, you're not looking for a convicted murderer like Koberger to live in the Ritz-Carlton like he's getting. But at the same time, though, they are to be afforded at least, you know, the ability, especially pre-trial, to live and be able to not be deprived of food, sleep, sunshine, the ability to go to the bathroom without eating it. I mean, this is, I mean, some crass stuff he had to do and he was suffering. Pre-trial for years. It makes no sense to me whatsoever. And then to be not denied counsel on so many times.
Are we just so quick here in our country where if you've been charged with something, it's just, well, you must be guilty. So we don't care what they do to you.
Well, that's what it feels like.
Now,
then this goes into the other thing we've been seeing too. It depends on what class you are. You know, if you're the Epstein class, well, then you are innocent and everyone else is guilty, you know, so but
you work at the CBS and you have no track record, well, we're going to torture the shit out of you. And you better be stronger and hold up to it because I know I could do it. Because the stupid things people say where they're like, well, I wouldn't have confessed. Really? Really?
We both said the same way. Really?
Really? Really? Yeah. I think if you were put into those situations, I think you could have gotten me to say I was Adolf Hitler or something after you're being put through that sort of shit. You would identify as anything you wanted someone to identify you as if it would make them stop torturing you.
And here's the real key to that, Tony. In any situation, that's exactly what we would do, where most people would do, a vast majority of people do, to make their own suffering end, because it's that grueling, that's horrible. But he never once said he confessed for himself. He did it because his wife's concern was what was doing to her.
Yeah.
That is what was most striking me throughout this entire thing, was the focus on her, the focus on family. He is the one that is suffering, and and this is the other thing too. Her heart was breaking listening to him. People that do abhorrent things to teenage girls or any women or anyone else do not garner the kind of healthy relationships that you saw coming back to him from her. It just doesn't happen. You never saw anyone coming to Lori Daybell Vallow's defense saying, oh my God, what are we going to do without you? They're all like, who? Do we have someone named Lori Daybell Vallow in our family? But you see what I mean? So all you got to do is do a very cursory comparison to anyone else that you've seen in any other situation like this that's being, accused of anything, and look at their reaction. Look at the family's reaction. The best teller of guilt or innocence in many situations is, what do the people around you think? Are you in healthy relationships or unhealthy? I mean, that's literally the first thing I do in every single situation when we have a horrendous thing happen and we have people of interest that pop in my scope. One of the filters I use is, does this person have healthy relationships or unhealthy relationships or no relationships? And that is one of the first filters I start doing. And this guy had healthy relationships, both his feelings towards his wife and family, and more importantly, theirs towards him.
Yeah.
Because you didn't, I mean, now granted, you could have trauma bonding and things like that. But when the perpetrator's behind bars and being treated like that, the trauma bonding is going to get broken at some point.
What's so sad, I mean, what eats me up about this case is Richard Allen already had some mental health issues, to depression and anxiety, as many of us do. And I can't imagine what he's going through right now behind bars, because they're still being insanely secretive about everything.
And he's accused for the offense that he gets, you know, the big D behind bars too.
Yeah, he's behind bars now. I mean, and there's far less communication. Kathy Allen's had issues just trying to be able to get in contact with her own husband. It's insane. Look, if we get somewhere with this, great, and I hope to God he gets another trial. My concern is him surviving long enough to even get there. And I don't know that we're going to get there, but I do know, and I hope we do. But either way, all of the fuckers in this that railroaded this, for whatever reason, their names need to be known. And their unprofessionalism, and whether it's arrogance, whether it's stupidity, whether there's another reason behind it, that all needs to be figured out. Yeah. And if it's just stupidity and arrogance, then they do not need to be in places of power that they're at. because God knows who else has been affected by their shit decision-making. And I'm going to guess there's a lot of people on that list. It's so messed up, and there's so many questions, and that's why we're going to keep following this, because it just, it's dark, and it doesn't seem to end. Every time a new chapter opens, it's like, oh, well, this reconfirms just how bad the investigation we thought was, tenfold. It's shocking.
I'm sorry, before we go, you said, I hope he survives. Well, the one thing that keeps people surviving is hope. And I hope that he knows how much people are thinking of him, and his lawyers are working. When I saw this thing pop again, I'm like, we have hope. Hope for justice. Yeah. And again, if nothing else, let's keep the focus on the victims.
Yeah.
Since there's an edge of doubt here, wouldn't the victims like definitively to know, by fleshing everything out, that this was indeed either him or not him, and that the actual perpetrator actually died in prison, like some of the theories are, that it's concluded? So let's just get some truth and some transparency so that the victims can finally have closure, and no doubt.
Without a doubt. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, your current book, Unbreakable Alliances, available wherever books are sold. Be sure to go and check that out. Thank you so much for your insight, as always. Until next time, for Robin and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.